Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Morning, it is Wednesday, time for the Doc of the Rock, our first doc show since we went into the red status last week with the hope of maybe trying to help put the brakes on our increasing positive COVID numbers. We heard some hope from the ESC the following day's number was going down, and what's up?
I don't have you.
You don't have me?
Well, not much. Okay, go ahead.
All right, we're going to try it again. I practiced that one first. Good morning, it is Wednesday, time for Doc of the Rock, our first doc show since we went into the red status last week with the hope of maybe trying to help put the brakes on our increasing positive COVID numbers. We heard some hope from the ESC the following day's number was going down, and they hoped it would continue, but our numbers are still pretty high and we're considered now to be in an extreme risk situation. 63 new cases were added to our count yesterday, with 35 coming from Monday's testing. We now have 541 cases in the borough, with 224 active cases, with 19 hospitalizations, and sadly, two deaths. There is hope on the horizon with a vaccine coming in sometime in the near future, but it looks like it's going to be a long winter of waiting. And here to talk about some of the issues we're dealing with is Dr. Shanna Theobald from the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic. This would be a great day for your questions. If you have any, call us 486-3181 or shoot us an email, lowdown@kmxt.org, and I'll try and answer your question, or Shanna will, during the course of the show. It's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Sorry, I muted myself so okay. That I wouldn't create background noise.
I'm thinking, oh boy, this is going to be a repeat of last week. And we did so much testing. You just, 2 weeks ago, you were in the midst of the COVID and you looked terrible. You really did look terrible. So there's hope. There's hope in your smiling face. Tell us a little bit, if you can, what is it like to personally experience this brutal disease?
Yeah, I think in a way we got lucky. I would consider our symptoms mild and moderate compared to, you know, how bad it could be. But it was not fun. It was like a bad flu and pretty just, you know, draining, exhausting, really fatigued afterwards. A lot of brain fog. The brain fog was interesting because it's just like you can't think clearly. You just literally feel like your brain is kind of cloudy and not processing correctly. Like you look around and don't really see, can't focus and see things very well. And I know a lot of our friends that have had it in Kodiak, we were all, you know, trying to get back to work after we're cleared by the public health officials, which is 10 days from the onset of your symptoms or from your positive test. And a lot of my friends were saying, you know, I wanted to go back to work, but I just don't feel ready. And that's kind of, yeah. I mean, I ended up having a couple of other medical things on top of it, but definitely took longer to recover than I thought it was going to. So there is, you know, downstream effects that you don't know what's going to happen.
So, and you said it was fair to mild. I mean, from judging by what you look like, I would not say it was fair to mild. I've seen sick people, and you fit right in that classification.
I guess on the scale of moderate being, you know, hospital admission, maybe needing a little oxygen and medications, and more severe being critical care, ICU, you know, some of the really sick patients. That's my scale.
So yeah, if you don't have to go to the hospital, it's mild to moderate. Great. Yeah, which leads me to that question. You know, if you are young and healthy, and that's what you experienced, and you're still sort of feeling the residual effects of it, I assume. How do we really know? You know, there's all this talk about the long haulers and the long term ramifications of this. With it's not very bad, you know, because if you get it, you'll recover. Well, mm-hmm. you know, we're looking at heart attacks and strokes and of all kinds of things that they're already identifying 8 months into this.
Yeah,
you know. Those are the things that they're identifying right now as like long-term effects. How can you identify a long-term effect if it's only been a short term?
Yeah, I think time is going to tell. And there are, you know, people that got it back in March and April who still have shortness of breath and difficulty going up and down the stairs. For example, some of my family's friends in Seattle area are still struggling and they're getting better, so we don't know how long those residual effects are going to last for, because we just haven't had the time to see, you know, what how it's all going to play out for a lot of people. But our friends here in Kodiak that are, you know, they're out of the hospital, they went home, but they're still on oxygen, and there's no telling how long that's going to be needed for each person.
Yeah. We did have a question from a listener who wanted us to identify the type of people who are getting this, in particular, like age groups. I know in, do you know what the local numbers are? I know what the Alaskan numbers are. They broke it down into ages, you know, of the total pop. Everybody throughout the whole state, we've seen people from the under 10-year-olds all the way to the over 80-year-olds who've got it. But do we know what that number is locally?
That's a great question. I don't know what the local number is. It would be nice to see some of those numbers published from the EOC or public health. There might be a way to get them. I could probably ask for them. But I do, what I've heard is that it is, you know, the same, pretty similar to the Alaska breakdown. I mean, people in their 30s, 40s are most commonly getting it. I think just being in the higher risk or the higher exposure category at this point, a lot of the people that are in higher age groups are trying to kind of, you know, stay home, stay away from others. But as far as, I don't know what the hospital stats are, but I do know, you know, is people 40s that are healthy, no known underlying medical conditions that got pretty critically, you know, close to critical illness. I don't know the ages of like the ones that are really, you know, getting medevaced or having, and we have two deaths now associated with COVID on island. I think we're both older in the higher risk age group, but I wish I had those statistics for Kodiak. That's a great question. I'll look into it.
Well, I know it from the state numbers that I saw, there were, of all the numbers that were indicated last week, they said there were 30 people under 10, 56 in their teens, 82 from the 20 to the 30s, 88 from the 30s to 40s, and 70, 40s, 65, 50s, 56, 60s, 28, 70s, and 4 in the 80s. So it's not discriminatory, this thing. It just gets everybody.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I think it's that working, you know, the category of age group that's going to be working and more exposed and getting it is the 30s to 40s group, which makes sense.
Yeah. I just got passed a message that said that those numbers are on the dashboard, the EOC dashboard, which I don't have up in front of me right now.
Oh, that's great.
There's a link on our page, Pam is telling me. You should be on the show, Pam. To your knowledge, how are we doing capacity-wise in Kodiak? I mean, do we have the capacity to keep going? I mean, I know you before the show you indicated you were thinking of putting yourself on a list. to be a secondary provider. Is that right?
That's right. Just a backup provider in case we do get to the point where we're needing extra healthcare staff. Yeah, I would sign up to help with overflow capacity if needed. I know there, I think there are currently, I looked at the numbers yesterday, four or was it three that are currently hospitalized. Six currently hospitalized as of the report from the ESC yesterday, which is, you know, it's increasing. It was four, I think, and then two got discharged. One was medevaced out. And then now we've got six hospitalizations. And we know that hospitalizations and critical illness follow. They lag behind the increase in numbers. So I think, you know, just based on the trends of this virus, we should expect to see an increase in hospitalizations here in Kodiak and illness and death, unfortunately.
Well, apparently they still have, even though capacity in the state is starting to get sort of crunched, they were able to get somebody out of here yesterday, which leaves, I wish Steve was here to answer this question about the capacity at the hospital, but things aren't trending in a good direction. I mean, we're still waiting for if there is a surge from Thanksgiving travel and Thanksgiving meetings.
Yeah.
Which we should see within a week or so.
That's exactly right. I would say 2 to 4 weeks to really see kind of the full effects from Thanksgiving travel, 2 to 4 weeks following Thanksgiving Day. And then definitely with the there's more Christmas activities, holidays. It's the season that people want to be together. I think we'll probably, if we don't, you know, just stop sharing air spaces, stop traveling, you know, interacting, we are going to see those numbers increase. Yeah, and I did find the EOC dashboard, 20 to 29 is Kodiak's highest at 22% of the cases. 30 to 39 is around 17%. 40 to 49 is 15%. And then it kind of just drops off 50 to 59, 60 to
60. Really? Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. So are higher in the kind of 20 to 40 category.
Just a curious question. You know, the reports that we see coming out from all over the country and all over the world in regards to the medical profession, the nurses, the doctors, the healthcare professionals that are working in there, the long-term care people. I mean, you folks are well aware of the dangers of this and protect yourself like way better than any of us would. Why is it that this virus is still able to make such an impact in the medical community?
I think that's a great question. I mean, for some families, it's just, you know, what your family risk exposure is in general. Like in our household, it was my husband's job, which is essential, and he has to be around other people, and as do I. I think, you know, so far we've been able to have enough PPE in the medical institutions where we work. And I don't know, the transmission rate can be very low in the healthcare setting because the healthcare providers are, you know, following all of those protocols. I know in the lower 48, physicians who have attended church services or, you know, attended family gatherings or other events where they're going to be exposed to people outside their bubble. I know that's where a lot of healthcare provider cases have come from. And then also, you know, you are around a lot more of the virus when you're in the hospital, and there is a chance that that virus could be in the airspace if you, you know, take your mask off or have to do something where you might not have full coverage or protection. But that's, yeah, as far as transmission to healthcare providers, I don't have the data on where healthcare providers are getting it from the most. But from the cases, the case studies I know about, it's usually not necessarily in the healthcare setting.
Wow. Because you have a life outside of the healthcare profession. So that's, yeah. So would you assume that that risk is higher than it is actually in the working environment then?
From the small number of case studies that I know of.
Yeah.
And who knows how much is, you know, who knows what the airspace is truly like at the grocery store or at the coffee shop or, you know, at some of those places where you're wearing maybe a cloth or a surgical mask, but not an N95. I've wondered about that because there have been a lot of, you know, cases here that they're not sure how the transmission happened, and people, you know, only went to the grocery store or only did some errands and had a covering. So it is hard to really trace exactly where all the transmission is coming from.
Yeah. And that's pretty troubling because, you know, the question for all of us is then, you know, if it's getting into the medical community somehow, and you are well prepared for it, how are the rest of us supposed to protect ourselves, given that you guys have the benefit of the knowledge and the PPE and good practices, and you can't avoid it?
Yeah, I mean, I think really, there is a lot. We know there's a lot that each person in the community can do, and it is wear that mask, keep the distance when you're in those public places where other people are also going to be, and don't mingle outside of your bubble. And bubble really means nobody else has any other contact, close contact with other people, which is, you know, it's pretty strict. And I think the majority, you know, a lot of people have been a little bit lax on those rules, especially in Kodiak, because we didn't have any cases, and, you know, people would talk to each other a little bit more, maybe be like, oh, you know, I know this person, so we'll get together and do something. And then I think that's where all the transmission just quickly happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem I see is that we had so many of these false starts. You know, we back in April and May, you know, we thought, It was coming. And then maybe it came a little bit, or it didn't come. And then it came and nothing happened. And then, you know, the August events were going to happen, and that was going to be a spreader event. And we had a number of those, and they never really resulted in anything. So I think people kind of put their guard down. And now we're in a situation where people are still maybe of the state of mind that, well, you know, this is overblown, and I think I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. But now's not the time to let your guard down, because it seems like now it really is happening.
That's exactly right. And I think if we could change that mindset to say, oh, you know, we did all these things and then it was okay, to realize, like, because we did all those things, Kodiak was okay. And it's that hammer in the dance. When we put the hammer down, the cases stop. As soon as we start letting up again, letting our foot off the gas, so to speak, cases flare up. And the more we intermingle, you know, have those transmission points, go back to church, talk a little bit longer in the grocery store than we used to, those are the things that will let the virus spread. It's just the kind of virology and science of it. And so, but the same still holds true if we do put that hammer down, if we do, you know, stop all those points of transmission, we can bring the numbers back down again, and we will, but we have to do that, and we have to do that collectively.
Well, how do we get the community transmission out of the equation, though?
Stop interacting at any point where you're with somebody, you know, within that 6 to 10 feet for 10 minutes is going to be a potential point of transmission. And so it really is limiting those points of contact.
So, well, tell me a little bit about when the community, as you know, now we go to a critical level, they make a reaction to reduce occupancy by 25%. Project that out to how long you could be in that environment before you could see numbers start to come down. You know,
yeah, I think in the past, in the national data, when a community has gone into kind of a stricter, I don't want to call it lockdown because it really isn't a lockdown. A lockdown in my, well, everyone has a different definition, but in my sense is like, you know, everything's closed. There's no interacting. You're basically, everyone's locked inside their house except for essential workers. But when, you know, as you kind of decrease how much community interaction there is, 2 to 2 weeks or so is when you really see that lag time period, because everybody who was exposed before that moment in time, you know, when you kind of put the brakes on, is going to play out their symptoms in the next 2 weeks. And so after that's when you're going to really see the effect of the lockdown.
So we're up to a transmission rate of like 1.6. Is that somewhere in that range?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is pretty high.
Yep, that's very high.
So
And it would be higher, just real quick on the transmission rate, because I think it's confusing. Again, I think we've talked a little bit about it before, but the transmission rate of 1 is where you're just maintaining number of cases. Transmission rate of 2 is where you're in that exponential growth epidemiological curve. And if we weren't, I mean, there's a lot of people in Kodiak still being very careful with, you know, masking, distancing, not traveling. If we were to just completely go back to normal, that transmission rate would probably be a lot higher, like potentially 2, 3, 4. In the very early stages of COVID, I think it was a transmission rate of about 3, and then it went down to 2, and that's gone down close to 1 in Alaska, or less than 1 a few points when we really put the hammer on. Yeah. But yeah, I just want people to know that that rate is directly related to how we behave.
So what does the 25% reduction do in terms of, does it change the healthcare environment?
As far as what?
As far as how your clinic can conduct business, as far as how the hospital has to work, you know, as far as the amount of people in there. I mean, if they're limiting people everywhere. I got a question last week that came in after the ESC folks came in about the effect the occupancy rule is having on dental clinics and the ability of parents to take their kids into the clinic.
Yeah, there is an effect. I mean, whoever needs care, any emergency care, it doesn't affect that. It does affect what it has meant for the hospital is that non-essential family members can't go in with you to, you know, a procedure or an appointment. Just trying to limit contact numbers, basically. As you know, if you need services, it doesn't affect that. If it's an emergency, you're going to get the care that you need. And then also, the main thing is just really trying to reduce non-essential appointments. And I think for dental, what it has meant for them is that they're really trying to limit it to emergency and, you know, if it's really urgent, and just avoid anything that isn't needed, because it really is the number of contacts. There's a really cool graph. It was like a animated graph where it's just like, you know, when one person affects 2 people and each of those people affects 2 people, you can kind of see how quickly it will expand. But when you take out a few points here and there, it makes a huge difference for the numbers that will be affected, you know, after so many transmissions, so many generations of transmission, so to speak. And it makes such a huge difference. So, and it's all on a spectrum. It's not black or white. It's not all or nothing. The more we can reduce it, so 25% is better than 50% is better than 75% as far as, you know, how much capacity we're trying, allowing people to kind of interact at. And I think the 25% was trying to really kind of find the middle ground, the best of both worlds, where like businesses can still stay open and hopefully make it through the holiday season, but really minimize. And there's the big thing is, what goal are we going for? One goal is to have no transmission at all and to keep the virus completely out of Kodiak, which is not going to happen because we can't all just stay home for 2 to 4 weeks. Everybody, I mean, everybody, even essential workers. And then the second goal is to keep us from overwhelming our healthcare capacity. So to be able to treat everyone who comes in and provide, you know, the standard of care treatment for everyone. And I think really that's the goal, but there's not a lot of margin of, there's not a lot of room. You can quickly overwhelm the healthcare capacity if you're not careful and kind of keeping us on the lower end of this, the transmission kind of spectrum, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It sure seems like we're getting to the point where we're getting close to that, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, with our numbers the way they are now, ideally we would shut down, we would lock down, we would go back into lockdown mode and just get through the holiday season and get through when we have a vaccine, which the dawn is so close to breaking. And if we can just hold out a little bit longer, and probably a little bit longer than we want to, just because, you know, the logistics of Alaska's getting monthly supplies of the vaccine. So it's going to be month to month that people will be able to be vaccinated. But if we could just hold out for the next 1 to 3 more months, you know, and just really stay as locked down as possible, we will see the least number of deaths in our communities and also, of course, morbidity, which is, you know, illness that comes because of the virus.
Yeah. And if you were going to, I mean, what has happened in your clinic, you know, as far as the general practice from the way things have started to compress because things have started to shut down? I mean, has testing continued to go up? Have, you know, in-person visits started, you know, you went to telemedicine for a while, but are those essential services the only thing that's being provided now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to put a disclaimer, since I have been out of clinic for the last 2 to 3 weeks, I've heard from my coworkers, but I haven't been in the, you know, the really front lines of it. But we are doing significant amounts of testing. I mean, the nursing staff has been really pulled to do the testing and it comes in waves. Sometimes there'll be 30 to 40 people that we test in a day. We do have 2 rapid tests now. We have the BD Veritor and the Cepheid test. So those are both an option. And then we also, of course, have the send out test to the Seattle labs for people who aren't symptomatic and are just screening and, you know, trying to see when, like if they can travel or when they can go back to work or whatever. We aren't doing testing for returning to work. But if someone had an exposure and is needing a negative test to return to work, that's the kind of send out testing we're doing. And as far, I know when I was last there, we were trying to really push for telemedicine appointments, anything that didn't seem like it needed a physical exam. So, you know, follow up on diabetes control or how a new medication is working for somebody or, you know, if we needed an exam, if it was like a respiratory problem, we needed to listen to their lungs. We were really trying to limit it to the cases that just needed to be seen in clinic and explain. I mean, I think people are very understanding, like the airspace in our clinic is potentially contaminated. So as a patient, like you want to make sure it's really worth it for you to have that potential exposure and obviously balance that with the need to be seen.
You said a couple of things that just set off a little alarm bells in my head. One was you don't do return to work testing. That means after a person's been quarantined for a while, you just assume that the amount of time that's elapsed has been sufficient, so you don't require them to get another test?
So in the case of an exposure, the recommendation from the CDC is isolate 7 to 10 days and get a test at the end of that period. So it's both a, you know, quarantine period and a test in right. order to return to work. For someone who's been sick, it's after 10 days of, you know, from the time that either you first had symptoms or had a positive test, 10 days you are cleared to return into the community and to work with, and they don't recommend getting a test at that point. Because most people are still shedding the virus, but from all of the data we have so far, they are not contagious. The most contagious period is in the 48 to 72 hours before they show signs of symptoms, and then in that really early symptomatic period. But after, you know, 7 to 10 days, it, from what we can tell from the evidence so far, which can change based, you know, as we get more information, things change and will probably continue to change, that is, people are no longer contagious in spreading that. So that if you're a known positive, they don't recommend a repeat test.
Huh. That makes it challenging for a work environment when you're trying to keep yourself safe and somebody has had it, been exposed, as to if it's exposed, then you say, bring me the test. But I thought at one point in time there was a test out requirement where people who had it had to be certified that they were ready to go. Now you don't have to do it anymore.
That's correct. In the early stages, we were testing, hoping that the virus would clear, but a lot of people were still shedding the virus 14 to 28 days after their first initial onset of symptoms. And then what had been kind of studied since then was that the virus was no longer active. It was dead viral genetic material that we were picking up on the tests, but not clinically significant as far as symptoms or contagiousness.
Well, that kind of changes how you would approach a quarantine. You know, when Dr. Mortensen was in last week, you know, he had come in close contact with a positive case, and they decided collectively that the family was going to go in and quarantine together. So they all kind of controlled their environment, and they all could go in and come out at the same time. But how does that change the quarantine when you're in a household with somebody who is positive, and then you're a close contact of, you know, how you can enter? I mean, for one, if I'm in that environment, I don't want to get this virus. So I have to protect myself as much as I can from the person that's positive. But now I'm kind of hearing that if they're positive, I don't have to kind of completely stay away from them anymore a couple of days after the symptoms, right? If they get the positive test, you can assume maybe two days before they got the positive test that they were actively shedding virus. So they might still do it for a couple more days. Is mm-hmm. that right? So
yeah, I don't know how long, probably seven, you know, within the first few days after that positive test or symptom onset is where the virus is shedding pretty well. But it's the tricky part about this is that, again, it's that linear, well, I don't know if it's a linear curve, but it's some type of curve where the shedding of the virus is at its peak right around when you develop symptoms, right before you develop symptoms, and then it slowly tapers off. And the activity of that virus for each person in each curve is probably a little bit different. We don't know, as far as I know, we don't have that information yet, how long each person is going to be shedding active, you know, virus that can infect somebody else. But from the literature so far, they think it's 7 to 10 days is when the majority of the virus will no longer be contagious, you know, 7 to 10 days after the onset of symptoms or that positive test. But we have a lot more to learn about exactly what is happening in that period and how, you know, how long. And if someone has a compromised immune system, they are probably shedding active virus longer than somebody who's not, because their immune system hasn't kind of jumped on it and killed all the viral particles off. That's theoretical. I don't know true data on that.
Well, you were quarantined. You had the virus with your husband mm-hmm. who had the virus, so you probably didn't have to worry about contacts with other people. But put yourself into that situation where, you know, somebody is in the household with a person that is positive. How do you safely, you know, what's your timeline for what you have to do and how you have to treat the other person if they're in the house but you don't want to have contact with them?
That's right. I think the timeline would be the same, 7 to 10 days.
You keep them in the bedroom. You don't have any contact with them.
Yes, exactly. Keep them in the bedroom. Don't have any contact with them. Keep the door closed. Really try to minimize exchange of that airspace. Obviously, you have to open the door to, you know, bring them food or water or whatever. But the CDC really recommends, you know, wear a mask. Both parties wear a mask so that there's minimal transmission of droplets. And then if they do have to share the same bathroom, that you know, disinfect the surfaces. I know in other countries they were doing a lot of spraying of chemicals that would kill the virus into the air to kill the, you know, active virus in the airspace, or minimize the time between when you go use the bathroom or any other shared, usually it's mainly the bathroom. I know a lot of people have put like a mini fridge in the room so that we can access something with, you know, really just minimize, really the whole point is minimize that contact with the other person to the bare minimum possible. And there have been a lot of successful cases where one partner in the household was positive and the other partner didn't get it. And they were, in those cases, the case reviews show that the partner who didn't get it was extremely cautious. They really, you know, they always wore that mask. They wore gloves when they touched the door handle. They disinfected the surfaces very often. The other partner wore a mask. They minimized how many times they had to open the door and get, you know, deliver something into the room. It's really difficult. When my husband and I, at first I think I mentioned this last time, but at first my husband and I were doing that where I was, you know, bringing him food, keeping the door closed, wearing mask. And then we just had other things going on where we couldn't distance as well as we would have under normal circumstances.
So you mentioned, well, let's just put it, you know, I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but if our goal is to keep this from spreading, is there, would you go to a grocery store?
If you were a known close contact?
No, not just in general. If you now have already had it. So let's assume that you're a person that hasn't had it before.
Yeah. I mean,
there are people now. When this first came out in April, people were scared to death. They didn't want to go anywhere. A lot of people didn't believe it, so they kept doing what they wanted to do. But the people that were real fearful of catching it from a surface or, you know, catching it from somebody two aisles over, that seemed to come back again now. So, you know, there's always questions about shopping and about dining, going into office spaces, shared spaces, our building here, you know, communal spaces. Are we being overly protective of ourselves to think that maybe it's a good idea not to go anywhere? Or are we feeling safe by knowing that there's only 25% capacity?
Yeah, I think at this point where we're at, it's good to be overprotective. There's no such thing as too overprotective at this point. Because one, you know, we're at the highest community transmission rates that we've ever been, and we're on that exponential curve. If you look at the EOC graph, we are on that just skyrocketing exponential curve. And two, protect each other for a little bit longer, minimize the number of deaths and hospitalizations. The problem with it is, like, right now we have enough capacity, but it does not take much to quickly overwhelm that capacity. You know, within 2 to 4 weeks of a major kind of super spreader event or outbreak, that's when you see the hospitals becoming quickly overwhelmed. And we're not going to have vaccine for the general population by that point. Hopefully we'll have been able to vaccinate some of our if at this point, I would say it's better to be overly cautious and minimize death and morbidity.
Yeah. I have a follow-up question about that testing thing. Without a follow-up test, how do we know somebody is really safe to go back to work if somebody tests positive? Is it safe to come back to work after 14 days?
Yeah, from the data we have so far from the CDC, it is thought to be that there's very little transmission that occurs after a 10-day period is really what the CDC is recommending. 14 days is much more likely, you know, it's probably fallen off to zero by that point. But it's definitely decreased to the point where the CDC does think it's safe for people to return to work after 10 days. If somebody was critically ill, they're likely to shed the virus, active virus, longer, or if they have a compromised immune system. So 10 to 14, they recommend 14-day period after someone was critically ill. But usually those people are not ready to return to work anyways. They still have residual symptoms. And so, and the, yeah, they'll know who they are and probably get that recommendation from their doctor to stay off work for 2 weeks. But as far as what we know so far, 7 to 10 days, it is safe. 10 days really is safe for people to return to work and be very, very, very low to no risk of transmission. I would say still wear a mask. You know, and everyone around them should still wear a mask. We will, you know, keep on doing the same, washing your hands, really mitigating the risk of spread. Act as if you, because you can still get it. The case studies so far that we know of, one person within 30, I think it was 30 or 38 days of their first infection had a repeat, different, distinct recurrence of an infection up to 90 to 120 days, I think is what we have data so far. And I think we're going to see a lot more of reinfections. So even, and generally the considered, you know, 90 days is what people say you're considered to have it, at least immunity that we know of so far. Some people will have it longer, some people will have it shorter than that, but 90 days is the period of hopeful immunity that someone who has the infection has before they have a risk of getting infected again.
Well, you know, the more difficult question is what the person who's in close contact has to do, because here you know if you got a positive test that you have to wait this much time, and you don't, you know, you can assume after the 14-day period that you can go back to work. But what about the person that was working with that person who's then quarantined and is sitting there waiting to see whether or not they're going to get the virus? You just have to wait the 10 days for it to pass to see whether or not you have any symptoms. But that doesn't really mean anything with this virus because you could have it and not have any symptoms.
Yeah. So 7 to 10 days, they recommend a test and a isolating for that time. Isolation or quarantining, really. Isolation is when you are completely away from everybody else. Quarantining is when you're staying home and staying away from work. But so make sure that you stay away from others for that 10-day period and test at the end of that, because you're absolutely right. My husband developed symptoms on day 6 after his exposure, and he was most contagious at day 4 to 6 from that time of exposure. And a lot of people, you know, it really is 7 to 10 days before they may start having symptoms and might be at that highest contagious point, which means that they'll likely be shedding active virus, which will be picked up on a test. So that's the rationale behind the quarantine and the test. And you can't test out of quarantine. A test at 7 to 10 days that's negative is much better than, you know, not testing at all and just going back to work. But that's what's recommended for Alaska and
So the question is always then, how far these circular bubbles actually go from close contact to close contact of the close contact, you know, how far down the road do you take it? I mean, if your husband was positive, you know, at some point in time, and then you identify all those close contacts, if you're in close contact with 15, 20 people, do all those people then are considered close contacts and they all have to isolate themselves for 14 days?
Yeah, I mean the line that was drawn, and of course there's so many, you know, it's always a gradient. It's not just black or white, one or the other. But the line that was drawn was if you have been in contact with a known case for
15
10 minutes.
minutes, yeah.
Actually, they decrease it to 10 minutes now. Any time throughout the day too, and with, you know, within 6 feet, you are considered a close contact. But if you're a contact of a potential, we have a lot of people coming to us saying, you know, my daughter was a close contact of a positive case. What do, and I've been with her. What do I do? And what we've been telling them is, you know, if you can quarantine, do it. If you can't, if you're an, you know, you have to be in person at your job, wear that mask, you know, wear two masks, keep your distance. I mean, wear, you know, the multi-layer mask essentially is what I'm getting at there.
Yeah.
Three layers is the recommendation. Keep distance from people, minimize your contact with anybody that you don't need to be in contact with. Let them know, hey, I was an exposure, so they can also decide that if they want to, you know, just call you on the phone rather than come in and see you in person at your business, or if there's any way to get around it, that's what we should be doing. And each time we eliminate one contact that we didn't need to, you know, talk to or be share airspace, it's really about swapping airspace. Like when you are sharing airspace, you are potentially transmitting it if you have it. The better off you and the community is going to be. And
well, but the 24-hour thing is even more critical. I mean, you can identify the 15 minutes if you can, you know, go in, do your business really quick and you don't have any contact with somebody. But if you're in a building and somebody walks into that building and does half hour worth of business and you're in a back room somewhere, I mean, doesn't that mean everybody in the whole community ought to be quarantined at some point in time?
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky that way, because there were a lot of case studies that came out of China that were exactly that kind of situation. Like, you know, a bunch of people in a mall who didn't talk to each other, maybe shared an elevator airspace that they didn't realize. There was a lot of really difficult, like, contact tracing you don't exactly know. And it could be that someone walked through the hallway, breathed viral particles out, and then got through the mask, and someone else breathed them in, you know, while they're adjusting their mask or because they have a mask that's not that effective. And it could be that simple, but I think it's all, again, it's all on that spectrum, and we're really trying to at least eliminate the highest risk.
You kind of still have to live, but if you're in one of the higher risk groups, it sounds like you're still in a place where you're not going to be able to come out for a while.
Yeah, I would say, yep, until the vaccine really kind of begins to get to the community. I'd say continue to stay in lockdown at this point. And that's what, you know, all the experts are really just hammering it. Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, Dr. Osterholm, there's just every kind of high level expert that you listen to is saying, we've got to get through these next 1 to 2 months. This is going to be the worst. Unfortunately, December, January are going to be the worst months, I think, that we see how this virus impacts the community. And the vaccine is coming, but we still have to kind of, you know, it's like that last little bit when you know you're almost at the end, it's almost the hardest time to wait because you feel like it's so close, but it's actually the most critical time right now. And I think we're going to still see it get worse before we see it get better. So just stay the course. At this point, just what I say is stay the course.
I'm going to get to these two other questions that I have. One, does it actually help to have staff or clerks wear gloves if they don't sanitize or change gloves between transactions?
Yeah, the gloves are probably more to protect the person who's wearing them at that point, as long as they're not touching anything else. If the point of the gloves is to eliminate risk in between, you know, customers or other people that they're touching, then it would be important to change those gloves. But really, the other thing is contact is, from what we have seen so far, not even close to the primary mode of transmission. It's maybe, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's pretty low. So whether or not gloves make that, and changing gloves makes that much difference is, I don't have the data on that. It's hard to say. But if you're really trying to eliminate, like nursing staff and people who are really in that high risk, absolutely need to change gloves in between people. If you're a grocery store clerk and like touching credit cards or something, that is less likely to be a problem. Yeah.
Okay. This we talked about a little bit before we went on the air. If there are multiple strains of the virus, and I want to ask you this about something that you just said about somebody who tests who gets the virus, it's now fairly clear that there's different strains of the virus. Mm-hmm. Is it one possible for somebody to get infected with a different strain of the virus if they've already had one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do these vaccines that are coming out now cover us for all the different permutations of this disease?
Excellent questions. Yes, and one of the earliest cases of repeat infection was two different strains of a virus. A guy, I think it was from Singapore, had the early, you know, Wuhan variety of the virus, and then traveled to Europe about, I think it was like 3 months later, and got the, when they looked at the genetic makeup of the virus, there were slight mutations, and it was the kind of the European strain. And there are, yeah, 4 to 6 new kind of what was considered genetic variants of COVID-19. Overall, the entire virus looks the same, you know, and the vaccine is targeted, as far as I've read so far, for a common protein that all of the coronavirus needs this protein in order to form itself, basically. And so the vaccine is targeted towards those particular proteins that are shared in common among all the different strains.
So does the testing that we do here locally differentiate between the strains?
No, we're not looking at the genetic makeup of the test. We're just looking for RNA that we know is a common sequence in all of the coronaviruses so far.
You know, I saw a report from a football team that had a game canceled that they were saying that there were 4 different strains of the virus that had gone through their training facility, and that one of them was the really bad one because that one was a super spreader strain, and the other ones weren't as problematic. They could contain that a little bit better. It seemed pretty odd to me, but it also seems to have something to do with community transmission. So if we have if we had that particular strain, our community transmission would go up exponentially.
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't see that article yet, and I would like to look into that more. It has been the concern that, you know, if there's a permutation that makes the coronavirus more deadly or more, you know, virulent, so it infects people more significantly, that is going to be a problem. And viruses do mutate quite readily. I mean, they're mutating almost every time. They're not careful when they're doing, when they're transcribing their RNA in the machinery. They don't have any correction checks, like most of our cells in our body correct for errors. They are going to mutate, and whether or not that becomes more deadly has been kind of the concern and the question that we're looking at. But yeah, I need to look more into.
Let's talk about that next week. That sounds good.
Sounds good.
Let's close this one with talk a little bit about this vaccine, the vaccines that are available. I mean, there's great news on the state front that, you know, we're getting a lot more vaccine than we even asked for, or we anticipated getting, which is good news. It's tomorrow, isn't it, that the statewide allocation actually becomes official, and the FDA yesterday made a recommendation that the Pfizer vaccine get approved. So
yes,
that's probably on the way pretty soon.
Tomorrow the FDA will officially make that decision, and it's expected to be approved.
So this is the Moderna is shortly thereafter. In the UK, they already started with the Pfizer vaccines yesterday. Kodiak, though, is in line to get both of them once they're both approved, right? And then the AstraZeneca ones maybe a couple more weeks down the road.
Yeah, Alaska is going to be receiving, as far as we can tell, 50,000 vaccines in the next month. About 36,000 from Pfizer and 17 or close to 18,000 from Moderna. And then AstraZeneca is trailing behind, but expected to have a vaccine available within the next month or so, a couple months. So Alaska is going to get a lot more than we thought we were. And I'm not sure exactly how they'll be distributed, because it will be a total of 50,000 in the next month. And as obviously healthcare providers first, but you know, there's a lot of healthcare providers in the Anchorage, Matsu area, and I think the red ANTHC, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, will receive about 11 to 12,000 of the first batch of vaccines. And yeah, and they'll probably decide how they distribute those. And I'm not sure how many Kodiak is going to get. Someone probably has more information on that that I don't know at this time. But
well, I think probably from when the state makes the allocation tomorrow, then it goes to a local level, right? And the local folks decide how it's going to be distributed in our community.
That's right. Yeah. And I know there was a way for clinics to apply to the Alaska state to get the vaccine for their providers. So yeah, I'm not sure the details on that from on the Kodiak level, but I know Dr. Mortensen, Dr. Jones would probably have more information. Dr. Kohler at this point will probably too.
Well, isn't it somewhat troubling though, that they've already like backed off recommending that people with certain conditions get the vaccine in the UK?
The UK?
The UK had some allergy issues that were not a big part of the studies. And so right now they're saying, you know, really only people that need it and that people will need to get it in a setting where resuscitation measures can be performed because of the allergy. So it's going to limit, at least up front, it's going to limit, you know, pharmacies being able to just give the vaccine. Like they are huge in helping with vaccination campaigns each season, pharmacies and like stores sometimes can like Walmart or whatever. But at this point, I think it's probably going to be more limited to clinics, depending on what, how the general reception of the virus is as far as side effects goes.
Would you, I mean, the test group for this, well, the one thing I heard, I think it wasn't available to anybody under 16 or 18.
Correct. Yeah. It's going to be available to people that are initially 16 and or over 16. And it, pregnant women were not included in this study. A lot of, you know, female health care providers are pregnant. And so I think 30,000 I heard from Dr. Osterholm. There's 21 million healthcare providers in the U.S. and they'll be obviously selected kind of first so that they're not transmitting the virus to other patients. But yeah, so there's definitely caveats with the vaccine that we won't know, we can't know until more research is done and more time elapses.
So if it comes into our community and there's an excess of vaccine over the healthcare providers who need it, and mm-hmm. they prioritize it down to then the elder community and people with certain conditions. I mean, doesn't that, it makes it a pretty tough decision about who's going to get it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the more you, the less vaccine you have for the numbers, the harder it's going to be to decide who gets it. I think this community has been amazing. And what I've heard from all the providers is they want whoever needs it most to get it first, you know, it, and really, I think Kodiak's a pretty altruistic community. I think people are going to be willing to just let whoever needs it, you know, whoever's determined. And there's a really great publication on the ethics of who should get the vaccine first. That was published recently, and it really just weighs, you know, who's going to spread it the most, who's the highest risk, who's going to die from it, who's marginalized, and, you know, what, like, a lot of the minority communities have the, you know, a lower percentage of the population and a much higher burden of the disease. So they, it's really well done, and I think most, you know, healthcare providers are going to follow right in that. It's not going to be a debate about, or it's not going to be like a me first kind of thing necessarily. Although at the same time, that said, when it's my turn to get the vaccine, or most providers have said, when it's our turn to get the vaccine, we'll step up and get it. And that's kind of, you know, part of the responsibility, I think. And the, as far as we know so far, the vaccine is incredible, has shown incredibly safe, you know, profiles and efficacy, effectiveness. And I think it really is, I mean, everything I've heard from skeptics who are like, you know, I'm going to watch this carefully and make sure the vaccine is safe, have been saying hands down, I would get the vaccine when it's my turn to get it. And I want to get it. I want to be part of that kind of safety in our community.
From polling, though, it sure seems like there's a significant portion of the population are saying they don't want to get this They do not want to take vaccines. How much of the population actually needs to be vaccinated for it to be effective through the community?
Yeah, Dr. Zink said when Alaskans were polled, 60% of Alaskans would say they would get it, which is higher than the national average. And it's 60 to 80% of the population needs to be vaccinated or have some kind of immunity from the infection in order to be to have that herd immunity.
So that means that's counting all the people that have got it already, plus the people that get the vaccine. But that's then you're taking out a huge block of people that won't take it and the people that you're not going to recommend it for. So the balance of us, is in your mind, is there a difference between any one of these vaccines? I mean, is there data that says the Moderna one is better than the Pfizer one, other than the fact that it's cold, or this new AstraZeneca one, which is supposed to be, you know, a better one for older people and lasts a long time and is cheaper?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think the Pfizer and Moderna are very similar. They're both messenger RNA vaccines and seem to show very similar profiles, effectiveness. I think between those two, it's no, you could get either one and probably have the same thing happen essentially. And they're all two dose vaccines. And then as far as the AstraZeneca, it's an RNA vaccine, which has already been around. It's a different platform. They make it differently. That one is probably, you know, because there are other vaccines that have been kind of tried and true using RNA technology, it's more likely to be safe, but it's also less effective. It's about 70, what they've shown so far is 70 to 90% effective after the second dose. And there were some problems with the trial where they accidentally gave a half dose for the first dose, and about, I think it was like 20,000. And their numbers were reduced looking at those two different kind of dosing regimens. And it's going to be interesting to see how truly effective it is across the population. But there is decreased effectiveness in it, but maybe higher safety. So really, it's going to depend on what each person is looking for. Like if I was an older person, I'd probably want to be safer and maybe stay, you know, isolate or like stay distance a little bit longer just to kind of see how it was all going to play out. We'll get a lot more data as more people get the vaccine as well. And it'll probably change, to be honest. Like, who knows? We might find out it's less effective than we thought. There might be more side effects than we thought. But at this point, hands down, I would absolutely get the vaccine.
So the vaccine is on the way, but there's really no need to step back on anything. It looks like we're going to be in a distancing mask society for a long time.
Yeah, probably at least a few more months, I would say. It looks like
If it looks like we're not going to hit that vaccine amount until June or July or something like that, then really we're in the same situation for that long.
I think it's important to tell people, like, just hang on there for a few more months. So like, really think of this, you know, sometimes mindset is everything. Just realizing like, okay, I've just got a few more months to stay the course and get through this. It's like the end of a marathon, right? That last couple miles is the hardest and the longest, but you just have to hang in there to get through it.
All right. We're a little over time here, so we've got enough things that we can talk about next week. I have another question that I'll put to you before we close. Where are some tests sent off island for analysis? I'm not sure what the first word is. Are some tests sent off to island for analysis? Maybe why or where?
Okay. A couple of places. Most of them go to Seattle. And then when they are positive, then we confirm them in our state lab. So there are two, all the send out tests, all the ones that are not rapid and resulted on island, you know, where you get the result within that day, are sent out to Seattle or Anchorage. Okay. And that's because we just don't have the capacity to do all the testing here. Seattle has the highest amount of testing. Quest is the main lab and LabCorp are the two main labs that run those tests, and they just have a higher volume capacity in Seattle. And then Anchorage has the second highest, and then we've got the local ones. We don't run any of those tests here. We just do the rapid tests.
So is testing still as vital as it was perceived to be a couple of months ago?
Absolutely, yes, because you don't know unless you have a test result, and it changes, you know, it really changes people's behavior when you know you have a test versus, yeah, maybe I had an exposure.
Yeah.
For me, it changed everything. Like, I didn't think I had it, and I would have probably been a little bit less careful. I mean, we were isolating anyways, and it was pretty easy for us, but, you know, when people drop off food, you want to say hi to them and talk to them, and when I knew I was positive, I was like, leave it outside the door. I'll come pick it up after you're gone.
Yeah. Now, there was some talk about the fact that the testing wasn't going to be as available come January as it has been for the past 7 months. Are we still faced with that? Are we looking at shortages in the near future?
Yeah, so far I think we've been able to keep up, but that is always, like, with the higher the numbers, the more tests you have to do, the more critical the supplies become. I'm glad, you know, that some of the testing rules that have changed have helped reduce the number of tests. You know, you don't have to test out, of course, you don't have to test out once you've had a positive test anymore. And then also, hopefully, once people are getting the vaccine, you know, as we get, we do have about 5% immunity in Alaska now, about 36,000 cases in the state and 700,000 plus people. And we're going to get another, you know, 5% people vaccinated, hopefully within the next month. So all of those won't need to be tested. The more immunity we have, the less we're going to need testing. So hopefully we'll be able to keep up until we're into a safer place with it.
Let's hope we get to that safer place, you know. Next week, I hope to see your smiling face. It's really nice to see you recovering from this. And you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, how things progressed and if you're still feeling great and back to work by next week. And we're going to close the program and change over to a program from APRN called Line One, where the doctor, I think, today is going to be talking with people in similar situations as you who have had COVID and are recovering. So you want to probably tune in for that and listen to other stories from Alaskans who are dealing with this virus, as we all are. Safe week. I hope you feel better, and we'll be back for a group discussion maybe next week if we can we can free up some of the other doctors who are really busy. We have a really great medical community in this community, and we appreciate what you folks all do. And I hope you stay safe and that we can turn this thing around pretty quickly.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been great.
Okay. You have a great day.